cancer diagnosis at the age of 32, my mom and I talked a lot about the shock of that diagnosis, given several doctors told us you're too young to have endometrial cancer. After much discussion, we began to feel driven to inform and help educate other young women about what symptoms they should be concerned.
Having both been teachers, it seemed natural for us to look for a way to share Alex's cancer journey in order to help other young women avoid such a shocking diagnosis or possibly navigate a similar path. A podcast seemed the best way to get the word out, and that's how Down There Aware was born.
4 years later, our mother-daughter duo has gone from educating and informing to advocacy and action, with a fresh and sometimes very interesting and somewhat humorous multi-generational perspective.
We look forward to sharing with you season 4 as we advocate, take action, and make it a priority to always be
Down There Aware.
Welcome back. We're happy to be starting a new... Go ahead and take it away.
I'm leaving all this in.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Welcome back to another episode.
I was distracted.
Okay. Every time... You have to know. Every time we sit down to record an episode, and if you are watching us on YouTube, you know that we're doing this the same day we did last week's because we're in the same clothes. But you know that I start things.
Because I have my mind on other things.
Like I don't? Okay, Mary Massey. Tell it like it is.
Oh, I just can't multitask.
You're the busiest
right
person
now.
In the world.
Yeah.
Anyway, today we are talking about...
Well, some things we have seen come across our... computer screen as we're researching. Mm-hmm. That's always interesting to me. You know, you look one thing up and then five different things come up and that kind of like squirrel. You know, it's
it's
a deep dive mm-hmm. into so many things. So I thought it might be interesting to bring up some of the ones that were the most interesting and discuss those because everybody may not be digging into stuff like we are and they may not know about some of these things.
True. So, well, and if we learned anything from last week, you know, just knowledge is important and being aware because, you know, who knows if Hank would have gotten his, gone to the doctor and expressed a concern about his lymph nodes if he hadn't had those other, you know, precursors.
And wasn't informed about it.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the first one I want to talk about is a groundbreaking vaccine trial that aims to prevent cancers that are associated with Lynch syndrome.
Interesting. And if you've been a longtime listener, you know that we've talked about Lynch syndrome quite a lot because Lynch syndrome is a genetic variant that predisposes those people to all kinds of cancer, but mostly in the lower abdominal region. So uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer,
stomach,
penile cancer, stomach cancer,
liver.
Wasn't there a cancer of the peritoneum? Mm-hmm. I mean, but it all kind of in your guts area.
But also brain and some types of skin cancer.
Interesting.
Yes.
And we know that one of the first things, because I was diagnosed at such a young age, one of the first things the oncologist did was get me tested.
Immediately.
Because it was almost an assumption, just like it was an assumption that, oh, you don't have cancer, you're too young. It was almost an assumption of, oh, well, you have this kind of cancer because you have Lynch syndrome.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I don't.
We had never heard of Lynch syndrome.
Nope.
So, again, a learning experience for us. And how exciting to hear about a vaccine trial.
Well, and and I'm kind of sciencey, but like, I can't wrap my brain around that quite yet because to me, vaccines are for viruses, but Lynch is a genetic disorder. I mean, it's a gene mutation. So how does that work?
Well, we're not sciencey enough to know that, but this specifically does say that there are vaccines that we already know about for cervical cancer, the HPV, and cancers that are caused by hepatitis B, like liver cancer. So there are vaccines for that, but this is the first, evidently, for a non-viral cancer. Which I think it talks a lot about DNA errors and how Lynch syndrome fits into that or doesn't fit into that. And the big takeaway for me from this article is that this is not about curing cancer. It's about preventing it. That we've worked on trying to cure it for years and have made some strides, but we still haven't been able to cure cancer.
Yeah. Well, and it goes into the whole Conquering Cancer campaign, how they are trying to eradicate it, but they're doing it at a three-prong system. They're treating people who have been diagnosed with cervical cancer. They're getting people vaccinated before they even have cervical cancer, and they're getting people tested in the in-between. So, you know, you can't, I think it's great that we've attacked it, I think, probably reactionarily. That's not a word, but in reaction to people getting cancer, we have to treat it. But I think it's awesome that we're getting to a point where, okay, we pretty much have a routine of treating a lot of different kinds of cancers. Now let's move research into how can we get it so people never get them.
Yeah, and that's exactly Eduardo Villar Sanchez, who is the deputy chair of the Department of Clinical Cancer Prevention at MD Anderson Cancer Center. Now, I never knew there was a cancer prevention department. Yeah. How cool is that? So he's leading this trial, and I'll read this quote because I don't want to misquote him. He says, the development of preventative vaccines is not only going to help us impact the community of Lynch syndrome carriers by bringing them tools to prevent cancer and extend their healthy lives, which is a number one goal of this effort, but also we're going to learn much more on how to prevent other preventative vaccines that can impact other cancers. And hopefully this experience will also translate into other genetic diseases. This is just the first step. This is just a phase one clinical trial. Wow. I think that is so hopeful.
Yeah.
May never happen in my lifetime, but we've talked about the changing medical community and how things change. Some rapidly, some very slowly, but change is good in this regard.
And just the fact that they're on the stage one of clinical trial means this has been happening for a decade of in the research phases and in probably animal testing and things like that before it actually goes to clinical. So that's incredible because, you know, I'm thinking of BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Right.
I mean, if you could prevent breast cancer, you could prevent... I just saw... Jax, one of our favorite singers, did her Victoria's Secret song with a breast cancer. She wasn't a breast cancer survivor, but she was a gene carrier, and she had an 87% chance of getting breast cancer. So she had a preventative mastectomy and didn't have reconstruction.
I saw that too.
And so, anyway, we'll send the link to that video because it's really cute. But wouldn't it be great if young women didn't have to cut off their breasts because
they might
be able to get a vaccine instead? I'd much rather have a shot than a major surgery.
Some statistics about Lynch syndrome. It's currently the most common cause of hereditary colorectal cancer, and people who inherit the condition have an estimated lifetime risk as high as 80% for developing cancerous growths. About 1 in 279 individuals, an estimated 1.1 million people in the U.S. alone, have Lynch syndrome.
And isn't... I hadn't heard about it.
I've never
until
you.
I was diagnosed.
Yep. Me either.
I mean, that's absolutely crazy. And I don't know all of the costs that go into whatever, but I know because I had been diagnosed, and I think because of my age, that my insurance covered a slew of genetic tests. They tested me for every known genetic variant to cause cancer. And I came back with none of them. but why can't we do that on every infant that's born? And I get it all comes down to money.
Yeah, it does.
And you don't, you know, it's kind of like we talked about a little while ago about how the Department of Transportation won't put in a stop sign until somebody dies or put in a stoplight until, you know, there's been a bad wreck. And it's one of those, we're more reactionary than preventative for cost saving a lot of times. And that can be really frustrating when it's people's lives.
But look at MD Anderson with a whole cancer prevention department. I'm just thrilled to even hear about that.
Yeah.
And the thought of vaccines that can prevent cancer. You know, I know it costs money at the onset, but long term, just think of the savings.
Absolutely. Cancer is one of the most expensive businesses in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, truly, the business of healthcare and the business of cancer treatment is astounding.
Yeah. So this is very helpful, very encouraging. And you go, MD Anderson.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Another article that grabbed my attention was written by author and two-time heart transplant recipient Amy Silverstein. I wasn't aware of Amy Silverstein. She has written two books and has had two heart transplants, which is unreal. So,
I mean, it's rare to have one.
Yeah.
But a second on top of that.
Exactly. But her article is about, and it's kind of interesting emotionally, how grateful she is to have had two heart transplants and have had that kind of second chance, third chance at life. However, the immunosuppressant drugs that she had to take because of the transplants left her susceptible to a lot of things. Everybody evidently who has to take these drugs is at a dramatically increasing risk for diabetes, kidney failure, dangerous infections, and cancer. And that's what she wrote about. She has cancer now because in part because of these immunosuppressant drugs that she's had to take. And it's what I think is so poignant is that she basically says, you know, she's had an extraordinary life. She's very grateful. And this is a quote, but all too often this intense gratitude creates a cloak of silence that hides the realities of transplant life. And I take that to mean she's so grateful at what she's been given that she almost feels like she can't say, but this gave me cancer.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
And it also kind of makes me wonder, does she feel that that's been like thrust upon her of, well, you should be grateful you're alive.
And,
you should be grateful.
People say that to cancer patients.
Yeah. Like you should be grateful that you had two heart transplants. Some people die on the list never having had one. Like you should be grateful. And, you know, it does kind of make you. But again, I think just like Hank said, I can be both.
Yeah.
I can be grateful and also very concerned that this isn't, you know, the rejection, anti-rejection drugs cause a lot of these issues.
Yeah. She says she's so eloquent in her expressions. She says, and all of this is hidden well behind the pervasive gratitude recipients feel for their donor organs. When you are given everything, there is subtle and explicit pressure to ask for nothing more. And you know, you're given the organ of someone because a family agreed.
Well, the person consented.
The person consented. The family is grieving, but the, this organ has been given. You shouldn't ask to have to not take drugs that are going to give you horrific diseases. And that has to be a lot to live with.
Well, and it has to be really isolating.
Yes.
You know, in that you're already one of few who has had a transplant, and then add that you're a double transplant. And then now add that you have cancer on top of that. Like your lived experience is probably super unique.
Yeah. She goes, I learned a lot about transplant. I know some people who have had transplants, and so I've, you know, tried to learn as much from their stories as I could, but I learned from hers that the life expectancy for heart transplant patients hasn't changed substantially since 1988.
That's almost as old as I am.
Yeah. That was when she had her first.
Talk about, you know, we talk about the changing medical community. I would like to believe that there's research being done on how to make better anti-rejection drugs, or how to, I don't know, better prepare the body for to not reject the organ or whatever. But it really, we should have made more progress in 35 years.
Well, and that's one thing she says, that new transplant medicines, the research for that is chronically underfunded. Again, it comes back.
Everything comes down to money.
It comes back to money.
Yep.
This competing thought process of being so grateful mm-hmm. to have had not one but two heart transplants that saved your life, but then to be upset and disappointed that the medication you had to take in order to be a successful transplant patient is going to kill you now because of the cancer you have. So that's really, really a sad state of affairs. Something we probably, most of us don't even know anything about, because how many people get transplants? That's something I probably should have looked up. How many people get transplants?
I mean, like, I feel like there's a ton of people on the list, because you always hear about, you know, people on the list and making sure that people, you know, are organ donors and things like that. But I always joke that I'm an organ donor, but nobody's going to want my organs,
because
I've had so many issues. So
same,
I don't know. I even think about, like, well, they wouldn't want my skin because I have psoriasis, and they wouldn't want my eyes because I have a really bad prescription. And, you know, like, I've thought about all the different things. My liver's probably in pretty good shape.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know what? You leave that to the experts. You give your consent.
Yeah.
And then you leave it to the experts mm-hmm. to figure out if you can be of help to somebody else.
Yeah. And when I'm gone, I'm not going to need it.
That's right. That's right. So
exactly.
Do what you can now. Mm-hmm. But again, we look for more funding for things that are so dramatically underfunded. And this evidently is one. I never would have thought about it. You know, you hear about people take these drugs so that, I think I've heard them termed as anti-rejection drugs. But never have I ever thought what those do to people.
Mm-mm. I knew it was immune suppressant.
Yeah.
And I knew that people had to be careful about, particularly it came to light around COVID, where, you know, people had to be really careful with infection and wearing masks. And I feel like transplant patients were wearing masks on planes and trains
anyway.
Yeah. But I didn't, I don't know if this makes me sound stupid, but I didn't correlate with immunosuppressant with more likelihood of getting cancer, because our bodies are probably fighting off cancer cells every day as we age.
I never put that together.
And then it, you know, when you get cancer, it overcome, you know, the cancer has overcome your immune system at that point. But yeah, I never imagined. Did she say what kind of cancer she had?
No.
That'd be interesting if it was a specific kind that you're more predisposed to, or if it's just cancer in general.
Yeah, I don't know.
And then how do you know, and I'm not saying she's wrong, but just out of curiosity, how do you know that the drugs caused that cancer? Was she going to get that cancer anyway? I mean, we wouldn't know.
Yeah, I take that back. I just looked back over my article, and it says she has incurable cancer in her lungs. So
interesting.
I don't know. You know, they can do a lot of testing with cancer, where it starts and you know, all of that, and specific types of cancer. So maybe there is, I don't know.
Well, and I know, so being in your lungs, it's incorrect, but a lot of us assume, oh, smoker.
Yeah, but we've learned
that that's really not true. And I imagine that a smoker wouldn't receive 2 heart transplants.
Right. I would assume not.
So, you know, she likely didn't have other risk factors. Yeah, it's just, it's a sad thing, but good for her for bringing awareness to, you know, a hard topic.
Well, and that's what she said. She said, in the time I have left, mm-hmm. I want to, you know, get that out there.
Yeah. It reminds me, I follow a girl on TikTok and mom just sent me a video of hers. And I was like, I know her. I know her. I watch her on TikTok.
don't we think we know them?
Right. But she is in her late 20s, I think early 30s, and has a terminal ALS diagnosis. And so, but she's doing the same thing. She's mm-hmm. like, I'm just out here trying to get the word out because ALS is not a rare disease. It's not an old person disease. And, you know, everybody needs to be more aware of it. So it's good when people can take their own struggles and get it out there in a genuine way that's not attention seeking. It's, I just want to get this out. And that's what the podcast, that's what we wanted to mm-hmm. do, is just get the word out and find a platform to help all people be aware of all kinds of symptoms that can, you know, indicate cancers.
Yeah. So if we can just advocate for more research funding mm-hmm. For cancers in general, you know, but if you've been touched by a specific cancer and want to be specific about donating, all cancers need more funding.
Mm-hmm. For sure. We can't stress that enough.
Another and the last article that caught my attention that we're going to talk about today is that more and more younger adults are being diagnosed with colon cancer. And so this article discusses early symptoms that may not be perceived as troubling. Mm-hmm. And so they're overlooked by the patient and by the medical community. Mm-hmm. What stood out for me is that early onset colorectal is a disease that's increasingly found in young adults not old enough to qualify for colonoscopies. And to me, that says it all. If they're not old enough to qualify, then the qualification needs to be changed because they're being diagnosed with colon cancer.
Why is there a qualification age for what I have never understood about the healthcare system is if my doctor, a specialist, sits me down and we have a discussion of my symptoms or they do testing or whatever, and they say the next step is this test, an MRI, whatever you're just talking about, what's it called?
Colonoscopy,
a CAT scan, blood work, whatever it is. Why on earth are insurance companies allowed to say,
well, we know why.
I don't know about that. Like, I don't understand the lack of or the dynamic of power there with, like, my doctor is saying this.
Well, we know it boils down to money, but what I don't understand is if colorectal cancer, that's what we're talking about now, it applies to a lot of other things, is diagnosed early, it's going to cost a whole lot less to treat it and to the recovery that the patient has to go through. So isn't it worth the money up front if you're not putting out the money later?
Well, and not just that, but colorectal cancer at its worst, you end up with a colostomy bag and you end up disabled and you end up being more costly to our systems of government and healthcare and whatever than if you just got a colonoscopy and said, oh yeah, that's we need to treat that. And
exactly.
And because from what I understand, early on, or colorectal cancer that's caught early is relatively treatable.
Yes. If it's caught early.
Right.
This article talks about the proportion of colorectal cancer cases occurring in people under age 55 has doubled from 1995 to 2019, it's gone from 11% to 20% of people under 55. Yet the age limit was just
lowered
to 45. Just now to 45. And that's just a 10-year difference. What about the 20-year-olds or the 30-year-olds?
Well, and it really it makes me wonder from a broader perspective of what on earth is causing more double the amount of young people to get this disease. And I think a lot of people jump to our diet, colorectal cancer, you know. I don't know. Is that part of it?
Yeah.
Or is other forms of your lifestyle, is that part of it? Is it environmental? I don't know. But it's, it's crazy.
I'd like to think there's research being done about the causes.
You would think.
Excuse me.
But I'm going to tell you right now, if it is definitive, without a doubt, 100% that red meat causes, not gives you more inclination or whatever, but like causes, and any amount consumed. Do you know what an uproar that would cause in the general population?
Well, yeah, look what we went through with cigarettes and lung cancer.
Right.
Yeah.
And those aren't tasty. You know? And so it's just one of those things that's like, it's a part of our core as Americans. We eat burgers and steaks on holidays and whatever. And so it's, and think about the beef industry.
Yeah.
You know,
now, I'm not saying
it's beef. I'm just saying like,
that's an example.
An example. I mean, if they came out and said it was corn or, you know, alcohol or whatever, it would have the same impact. It would be like, how can we take that out of our diet? Mm-hmm. How can we do that? And then you would have individual people. My brother would be the first in line to say, all right, well, I'd rather have cancer than give up my steak. And, which it, maybe he wouldn't. I should put words in his mouth. But that would be my assumption.
Just, he does like his steak.
He does like his steak. And I bet there are people like that. So anyway, it just goes to show that it would be really hard, even if they are doing the research, if they have a definitive indicator or, you know, cause, how we would respond as a society.
Yeah. The purpose of the article is to get out the information about early symptoms that we may not associate with colorectal cancer or colon cancer. One is abdominal pain, rectal bleeding, I think we all have heard, ongoing diarrhea, and iron deficiency anemia. Those are the four that they say they have found have shown up to 2 years prior to a colon cancer diagnosis. So I guess people who have been diagnosed and then they do a history on that patient, they've seen that these things showed up 2 years before, and they've seen enough of that to say, okay, wait, these are definitely early symptoms, and we need to get that word out.
Well, and to, you know, we get TMI on this page, or this page, this podcast. I was having a few of those symptoms and was referred. I went to my regular doctor and was referred to a gastroenterologist. And sorry, my mic's being all wonky. And he asked my history and all of that, and pretty much said, "Yeah, you're too young. This isn't anything to be concerned about. People get diarrhea. People have." I mean, like, he was really basically just blowing me off, ignoring me, and pretty much said, "Take Imodium, you'll be fine." And this was before my cancer diagnosis, so I wasn't as empowered to say, no, we need to do some testing, or I am really concerned about this, or that's not something that is going to work for me. But how many other people who actually end up having cancer have that kind of experience at a doctor's office?
Well, I think after reading this article, I think there probably are a lot, because they end up being diagnosed. And this this article speaks about how we kind of brush past patients who talk about, oh, I've had diarrhea, or, you know,
yeah,
we kind of brush past it. But this doctor says, if what I tell patients is if you have some diarrhea that resolves quickly, that's probably nothing to worry about. But if you notice that it's lasting for weeks or even a month, that might be something to have a conversation with your primary care doctor about. Mm. So I guess it's, you know, and that makes perfect sense. You might have eaten something,
yeah,
or you were on a trip, or you didn't sleep well. And that
there affects, are all kinds of right, things that affect your gastro system.
But the doctor goes on to say, if there's something that you feel that's out of the ordinary, push a little harder for more diagnostic tests. Now, isn't it a shame you have to be the one to push a little harder?
Yeah.
But isn't that what we continue to talk about on the podcast? You have to know your body and be your own advocate.
You do. And you know your body best.
Yep.
I mean, you're the only one going to the bathroom with yourself, you know, like you know, and you know how you feel, and you know when you're having a good day or when you're not having a good day. And, you have to speak up. And it's unfortunate that that is so important in, you know, the realm of diagnosis and treatment and all of that, but it is, and it's one of those realities that we just have to accept and proceed forward.
Yeah. Just, be your own advocate. Push if you don't feel like you're getting what you need. We talked about second opinions a few mm-hmm. weeks ago. If a doctor, even with you pushing for further diagnostic testing, if the doctor refuses to do it, then see a different doctor.
Yeah.
And that's not being overly cautious. It's mm-mm. just simply being your own advocate.
Yeah. Well, and if, you know, doctors generally understand getting a second opinion, they're not hurt by it, their feelings right. aren't hurt, whatever. Even if their feelings were hurt,
doesn't matter.
Whatever, like truly, yeah. whatever. You know, sorry, I need my health to be my number one priority, and you're not making that, so I'm moving on to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not hard.
No, no.
For the, you know, and are you going to see that doctor again? Maybe, maybe not. But even so, they should be a professional.
And if the trade-off is you prevent a diagnosis that of a disease that's gone too far to fix
yeah.
Or treat at all, then, you know, it's worth it.
For sure. It really is. So
that's the whole point of the article, and it states it very clearly, is we want to get the word out to young people mm-hmm. that you, just because of your age, doesn't mean you can't get colon cancer.
Yeah.
You need to be aware of these early symptoms and see a doctor if they persist.
Yeah. And for our UK listeners, if you need a reminder of the symptoms of colorectal cancer, you should go buy your toilet roll from M&S because they're listed on their packaging. And that is, you know, something that we're really interested in getting the word out about gynecologic cancers, is to put that on feminine product packaging. So we're working on that. It is.
We're trying to get Procter & Gamble to listen.
Yeah, we want them to listen. We've written them a letter, and we're also talking to smaller companies. And in that learning, from our perspective, it's easy. You put a QR code on this label and not a big deal. And we're learning that it's a lot more involved than that, and there's actually regulation, like federal regulations on packaging and what has to be on, much like cigarettes, right? Like you have to put the Surgeon General's warning and things like that. And so just kind of navigating that space. So we are working on that, but I don't want to speak for you, I was a little Pollyanna in how quickly things would happen.
Yeah, I was too. And I'm a little disappointed that we've received no response from Procter & Gamble.
But so, kind of not surprised.
Yeah, we're gonna try to persist and stick with it, because I believe it could make a huge, huge difference
yeah.
in informing young people women in particular, and that's what started the whole podcast. Mm-hmm. Young women who think they aren't at risk for gynecologic cancers because of their age,
or have zero clue about gynecologic cancers.
Yeah, what the symptoms are to look mm-hmm. for, what they need to be aware of.
Yep.
And the texting, the information on the packaging, we think could be a game changer. Yeah. And we want to see if we can't keep that in the forefront and mm-hmm. get something done.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Down There Aware. Be sure to like and subscribe on our new YouTube channel, as well as on your favorite podcast platform. You can find us at Down There Aware on all social media sites, Twitter, Pinterest, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. If you have it, we're there at Down There Aware. You can learn more on our website, www.downthereaware.com, and always get in touch with us, downthereaware@gmail.com. See you next week.